Welcome to Brain Junk. I'm Trace Kerr.
And I'm Amy Barton, and I'm so excited. Today is the day that we get to talk about whatever we want. Usually we try to bring you something that has a theme to it, and we'll talk about several different things within that subject. Today is grab bag. We're going to talk about little things we've encountered in our research for other things. I run into things when I'm trying to find something fun for social media, and I think, no, this is too good. I'm saving it. So I'm excited. Let's go ahead and get started.
And I think the best thing about this is neither of us know what the other one is going to talk about today.
Oh.
At all. Nope. Amy has been like top secret. I can't even look at her clipboard.
Yeah. So Trace is retaliating and I cannot look at her computer.
We're getting very petty. Yeah. So yes, today is everything you never knew you wanted to know about a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I'm going to start off talking about, okay, and so here's the other thing. We've kind of made a policy to stay clean. We don't have bad language, and we try to stay happy and upbeat. But this was so cool, and I've had it in my back pocket. I had to talk about Tomoe Gozen, who is a female samurai that collected heads like picking flowers.
Oh, excellent.
Don't worry, I'm not going to get too graphic.
We will not be collecting any heads.
No, but she's super cool. So I found this on culturacollectiva.com and then did some additional research. Tomoe Gozen, she's the only one described in detail in ancient Japanese war tales.
So that's a big deal.
It's a huge deal because she was alive during the 12th century in Japan. Mm-hmm. She kind of came to notice during the Genpei War between 1180 and 1185.
And this is not a Mulan situation? They knew she was female?
There is some thought that a lord at the time, that she and he might have had a relationship of some kind. But it's downplayed a lot because she was such an amazing warrior. And what's so cool about this is Lord Kiso no Yoshinaka appointed her as his leading commander.
It would make sense that she got in that way, but if they're downplaying that she was legitimately earned her place.
Yes,
she may have got in the door, but she earned it.
She was formidable. We have a little trouble with what is fact and what is legend because mm-hmm. she became this huge thing. Many accounts focus on her decapitation skills. That's cutting off
that is
of
dramatic.
The head. Yes. In one battle, she supposedly collected 7 heads. Now, this sounds really gross and barbaric, but at the time, having a whole string of heads on your saddle mm-hmm. would really show your prowess as a warrior.
Yes.
Also, she is said to have led 300 samurai against between 2,000 and 6,000 other warriors.
Wow.
Only 5 of them survived, and she was one of them.
Wow.
So even if it was 2,000, 300 against 2,000, mm-hmm. she was not only a great fighter, but clearly a great strategist.
Mm-hmm.
And the sad thing about Tomoe Gozen is that no one really knows what became of her. She might have become a concubine to Lord Kiso no Yoshinaka, or they think she might have become a Buddhist monk.
I like that idea better.
I do too. And then there is some thought that she ended her life in some sort of tragic way.
It would be real hard to go back to
being just a normal person when you've mm-hmm. lived this life as this great warrior.
And yeah. had such freedom.
I know it's a little violent, but she was just, I just love these strong female characters.
Yeah.
And so there you are.
Even outside of her being female, she is distinguished so broadly in so many ways, too. It's very noteworthy for the time.
Absolutely.
I would also like to talk about death now, but mine is insect related. This is what made me think I want to talk about this, but I don't want to do another animals. We've already done 2 animals. We'll do one again. There's plenty of time, but we've just done 2. So I want to talk about the beaded lacewing and particularly baby beaded lacewings. Baby beaded lacewings live in termite nests, and beaded lacewings are elegant looking. There's little green bugs that have iridescent, beautiful gossamer kind of wings, and these are in that same category. They're tan, but they do look kind of beady if you look at a picture. And they're more delicate than a fly. They're not a fly. They're in the Birathidae category.
Keep going. I'm just looking it up.
The little babies are larvae, as one would expect, and they live in termite nests. And they have to eat, and they are left to do so independently by their parents.
Ouch, cold.
I know, but they have some...
They are really scary looking.
They have a little something in their back pocket. They live comfortably side by side. The termites are not worried about them. Trace is looking at a picture. They're super excellent.
It looks like the alien that they stuck in the guy's ear in Star Trek way back in the day.
So imagine that. Scary. Imagine it living with termites. When little baby beaded lacewing is hungry, it's going to mosey up to whatever termite it's interested in eventually consuming. And it's like backing up toward it, doing the 3-point park turn until it's in just the right position. And then it does the death fart. And I've been waiting to say death fart.
Okay, wait, hold on.
Yeah. How good is that? The beaded lacewing baby death farts at the termite. There's technical scientific terms that I'm going to post to the website, but that's really all you need to know. Noxious gases. And nothing happens for a little while. You'll see this happen and the termites aren't freaked out. They keep going and doing their thing. But shortly, the termite stops moving and becomes immobilized. And that lets baby beaded lacewing eat it at its leisure. Or Trace has so many questions.
I do. I'm like, I want you to finish so I can ask them.
If baby beaded lacewing does not get to the termite in a timely fashion, like maybe it scatters and more than one termite goes down and it's just not hungry, that termite's going to die. It really is a death fart. You're not coming back once you're death farted.
What is in the death fart?
The death fart has...
This is so fantastic.
It is. This is makes me really joyful. And this is, by the way, wired.com. Thank you. Go check out the article because it's so well written. It's wonderful and amusing. Call it a vapor phase toxicant, which is released from its anus. So that's good. That's a fun anatomical term too.
Yikes.
I thought that I had finally hit my top fart fact with blue whales, but no.
No.
This surpasses it by leaps and bounds. So that was much shorter than Trace's really interesting one, but really worth the wait.
No, that was so good. I have an animal one that's also extremely short. I want you to listen to something.
Okay. Lassie, come home. Okay, what is that? I'm super curious.
That is the southern grasshopper mouse.
What?
It is the only carnivorous mouse in North America.
Oh, that's alarming. Tell me, you said southern?
Southern. So Sonoran Desert, Arizona, California, northwestern Mexico. Hot, dry.
Great. Not from here.
Yes. Not from here. They are super agile bug killers. They have a completely meat-based diet, which is very strange for mice.
Yeah.
And they look just like regular mice.
Ooh.
They eat grasshoppers, spiders, scorpions. Mm. They even eat other mice.
Oh, boy.
And not only are they amazing hunter, carnivore kind of things, they're immune to scorpion venom.
Really?
Yeah. So the video that I put up, I don't know. I'm going to have to double check. I've got at least one video up there, and it shows the scorpion whacking the mouse in the face with its stinger. And this toxin in human beings causes muscle contractions and respiratory failure. I mean, it can kill you if it stings you in the right place.
Yeah.
The mice convert the neurotoxins and the venom into a painkiller.
They are like super mice.
They are totally super
villains,
mice.
Though. That's kind of wow.
Yes. And so it's killed the scorpion, and then it stands over the scorpion, rises up on its two hind legs, and howls.
Ooh, really?
To proclaim its territory.
Wow. That is so barbarian movie. Like,
and what's great is you'll hear this, you know, the scream, and you're looking, and it's just this teeny tiny mouse with his little tiny mouth open, but he's just killed a giant tarantula.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's wow. And so those are why you're afraid that little rodents are going to nibble your toes. Holy cow. Wow.
Well, if one of those is nibbling your toes, they'll probably bring along their friends and then there wouldn't be any of you left.
No, that's wow. That's so Tim Burton movie right there. Holy cow.
I've been playing it off and on because I was trying to put a sound file in so I could have it later. And various people in the house had your reaction. What is that?
Yeah, initially my brain said Lassie come home whistle kind of thing. But as you listen a little more, it is not Lassie come home. It's so much worse. There are so many things that want to kill you where it's warmer. So many things. That's actually how I got Are You Done? Because I'm excited about my next one.
I am done.
I really love that. But it's a great, perfect connection because we are first international listeners to Brain Junk. We're Australians. Hi, Australia. We're super fond of you. So I thought, I'm going to look at Australia. And there's so many things that can kill you there. So many things. Like these crazy little werewolf fleas, the sea fleas that come out only in the full moon and eat people flesh. There's a show. Check out the Twitter feed. It's on there. My story starts 100 million years ago when Australia was covered about 60% with water. And that water eventually began to dry out and our continents became what they are today. But in that process, the drying out process and the high acidity levels and the silica that was produced resulted in 80 to 90% of the world's opals being formed in Australia. One statistic I read said that it takes 5 million years to create 1 centimeter of opal.
Wow.
Took a long time to get us the opals we have. And they're mostly in Australia. The natives may have been aware of it. But in 1915, somebody discovered, hey, these are cool. And opals had been very rare before because it takes some really unique circumstances to form them. So they were extremely precious. When they were found in Australia, there was a bit of like our 49ers, a gold rush. There was an opal rush. So in 1915, they were found. 1916, the first miners came in and they
dug everything up, didn't they?
They did.
Sorry, Aborigines.
However, in a win for the Aborigines, they don't really want this land. If you look at a map of Australia, you will see a population density map with everything orange and red means lots of people. It's on the upper left and the lower right. There's lots of people. And then there's a whole lot of blank space in most of the middle left. And so the town that was resulted from this opal rush is called Coober Pedy. And if you're an Australian, you'd say Cooba Pedy. I'm not going to try to keep saying it that way. I can't even. However, Coober Pedy. And, oh, I flipped my page, but you want to know what this means. The Aborigines did call it. They called it Coober Pedy, and it changed to the English translation there. But it means white man's hole in the ground, or white man's hole, or boy's water hole, or white fella hole. It literally means, hey, these crazy guys, what's with that?
White fella hole.
Yeah.
I think that's great. We should call every bar in the United States.
They're all Coober Pedy. As miners began to move in, this is in the central desert of central South Australia. It's hot. And estimates for temperature were anywhere from 113 to 120 at times. That is wicked hot.
Oof.
Underground in the mines, it's about 75 degrees. So as guys were moving in, they would just stay in an abandoned mine shaft or they'd carve themselves out a little place. And now, 100 years later, they did a census in 2016. There are about 1,700 residents.
Underground?
The census says about 50% live underground. The locals would tell you it's more like 80. So these are people that live underground, but it has changed a lot from I'm a guy with a lamp and a bedroll in a mine shaft. This is a whole town. Trace is looking it up now. I absolutely recommend look up Coober Pedy. Check out the real estate listings. That is super fun because you get to look in. It's like Zillow for Coober Pedy. And you get to see all these amazing, look like little square block rooms in some, but others are, these are hand carved out rooms. You can buy a plot and you could hand carve. There was one lady who moved there that she hand carved her whole house. She had a swimming pool in her house, all underground.
Oh, where are more pictures? Where?
Yeah, there's some really wonderful articles. Business Insider has a really fun one.
They look like bunkers. Well, this looks like a trailer, a double wide, sunk in the ground.
Yes.
They have no pictures of the, there are no pictures of the inside and it's $70,000.
The pictures range vastly too. Some people have taken serious care to make it really home-like and they've got beautiful lighting. Others look very cave-like.
Wow.
Many of them are built into hillsides because of the terrain. Your entrance is like a daylight basement. And so your kitchen and bathroom may have windows because I believe the plumbing is generally on those outer walls. One of the things I posted to social media to see if I could get an Australian to tell me.
Did anybody?
Nobody responded. They were all in bed when I posted. I know. They're all underground. That's my husband. He's like, what about internet? And what about plumbing? Because not just people live under there. They have businesses under there. There's churches. There's a beautiful church that has vaulted looking ceilings in it. It's so beautiful. And that rich sandstone color, they've lit it really nicely.
Wow.
So if you are in their big mall area, how do they get the plumbing down there is what I wanted to know. And you've got to get your electricity and your internet connections. So they must have some sort of way, but...
What I'm looking at now is one that the ceiling and the walls have kind of a flocked look about them, because I think it's probably plaster or something.
Oh, yeah.
But what I'm finding a little disturbing is they have this pullback picture of the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
and most of the ceiling has patches that are not the same color. And I'm wondering structurally, I mean, this is a really big, like imagine your entire kitchen and you've got a weight of dirt over the top of it.
That's what I wondered about too, is what are the regulations for building there? And one person on a website joked, you can no longer mine for opals within the city limits. You've got to be at a formal mine in a mining area or outside the city limits.
Yeah.
But he was joking, but you could expand your house.
Wink, I was just going to say, you got a closet and you just keep going.
That's right. Because apparently it can be that easy. I think they're coming at now that it's been 100 years of mining, it's not quite that easy. But initially it sure was, it sounds like, because it's fairly close to the surface. The ocean dried up and it's all right there at the surface.
Wow. What an interesting place.
It is. Water was an interesting thing. The initial plan was a 500,000 gallon water tank underground, and that was built in 1922, but was, as you can imagine, not very reliable because you still have to get water into it, and where is that coming from? And they do have artesian wells and they can sink a deep hole and get water, but you have to desalinate that water. So in 1927 they built a desalination plant, sunk a hole 100 meters deep, but it was solar, and so that's on the surface. And so any windstorm on this vast plain where the tallest tree is a metal tree that somebody in town bought, made, that it didn't work long. And so in the 80s, they built a modern desalination plant, and it sinks down 23 meters away from town and comes into town now. And so much more reliable, but they still have water problems. It almost never rains there. But when it did a few years ago, they got half their year's rain in one day, and it caused some serious problems because you don't have to plan for flooding there. That's not a thing.
Well, and if your house is underground and it's mm-hmm. kind of sandy, it's just going to...
Yeah, filtered right through.
Ooh.
They also had, I saw an article where a couple years ago, the treated water, the tap water, was smelling like chlorine. And so people were using pool kits to test, and it really was chlorinated. So there are definite, you have to be a hardy soul to live there because you really are dependent on, we live in such a water rich area. I don't think about it very much, but they're 500 miles from the nearest town. So you don't just run to Target and get a case of water if the store is out.
Wow.
Their grocery stores are above ground. They've got underground, they've got a pool hall, a bookstore, churches, a bars, hotels, so you can go visit. They are in a desert, and they have a golf course. It squares of AstroTurf at...
Above ground golf?
They do. And it's mostly oiled sand, but they have some strategically placed AstroTurf.
I'm not that hardcore of a person.
They filmed Mad Max here. None of us, not very much. 1,700 yeah. people are. Go look it up because it's just fascinating. And pretend to buy some real estate. Houses underground, about the same price as houses above ground.
They were, yeah. The last one I looked at was $330,000.
Oh, I forgot to tell you my favorite thing. They have signs all over town that says, watch out for holes, don't walk backwards.
Oh, God.
Because they're fairly close to the surface. And so people will sink daylight. They'll put a hole in for another skylight. And they've just got ventilation and they need somewhere for the, you know. Yeah. So all over town.
I just had this image of you're in your daylight bathroom with the thing. And all of a sudden this guy is like, oh, ah, splat. You know, and they're just...
Only once a year. You're not Santa Claus. Get out.
Mm-hmm. None of that.
So there's hazards.
Just looking at our grab bag, you and I definitely have a violent streak that cannot be satisfied.
That's true. I'm just looking at my last one, too.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the Ouija board. In the UK, you say Ouija. In the United States, yes. Here, we say Ouija. That's O-U-I-J-A.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a weird thing. You know, I've been to parties where they've got it, and it's a board that's like a game board, and it's mm-hmm. got letters on it. And then it comes with a planchette, a plastic tool with a little window through it. And
it's like a tiny coffee table.
Yeah. And you'd say, dead grandmother tell me something from beyond, and then everybody would put their hand on it, and it would move around the board and supposedly answer your questions.
Mm-hmm. Grandpa had horrible gas. Ask more important questions if you're contacting the underworld.
Yeah, he was one of those beaded lace ones. well, but it was a 19th century invention created by a group of businessmen who didn't believe in spirits, but were very interested in taking advantage of the rise of spiritualism in the United States. So spiritualism became popular in Europe during the 1840s, and it grew in popularity with Americans after the Civil War, because we had wars and people were dying and loved ones were gone and people mm-hmm. didn't know what to do. And a lot of people felt like religion wasn't answering their questions. And so spiritualism mm-hmm. rose up with mediums and people who claimed that they could talk to the dead. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of taking advantage of people's grief and pain.
Yeah.
And these guys were kind of jumping on that bandwagon. So the first Ouija board was produced by Charles Kennard in 1890 because people didn't want to pay a medium and they wanted privacy when they were asking family questions. You know, mm-hmm. if you were going to ask, where did you bury the family fortune?
Oh, you don't want a seance at a dinner
yeah,
party.
Yeah, we don't want everybody listening to that. So they saw the Ouija board like a telegram with the dead. In less mm-hmm. than a year, the Kennard Novelty Company opened 7 factories.
Wow.
6 in the United States, 1 in London, and it waxed and waned in popularity, upsurging after World War I and World mm-hmm. War II. Okay. But then in 1973, there was a movie called The Exorcist.
Oh, yes.
And in that movie, the Ouija boards took on a really sinister feel, and popular culture began to look at them not as a kind of a serious but kind of simple way to communicate with your loved ones. Instead, the Ouija board is now a way to communicate with the devil. Exactly. Satan is going to come through that Ouija board and drag you back down to hell. So people were completely freaked out about it.
This would explain my parents' reaction when they remodeled the bathroom in the 80s sometime, pulled out the sink cabinet and there was a Ouija board being used for backing, and my mom's like, get it out. And my dad was usually dad's pretty flip and sarcastic like me, and they were both like, yeah, it's out, we're getting it out.
Whoa.
yeah
so it's got that negative connotation. But so what I thought was interesting about them is how they work. So there's this thing called the ideomotor phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
and it happens. Well, here, let me explain it. So William Benjamin Carter discussed this effect in 1852. So the Ouija board hadn't even been around that long when people started kind of talking about what is going on and mm-hmm. what is happening. Scientific tests by the English scientist Michael Faraday and his collaborators determined that, quote, honest, intelligent people can unconsciously engage in muscular activity that is consistent with their expectations, and that suggestions can guide behavior given by subtle clues. So here's what's mm-hmm. going on. It's a psychological phenomenon where a subject makes motions unconsciously. So if you've got this board in front of you, and say you're trying to verify that this spirit is who you think they are, and you know the name of their favorite pet, mm-hmm. and you were to say, Mildred, tell us the name of your favorite pet so we know it's you, and you've got your hand down on that. Well, because you're already thinking Fluffy.
That is what I was thinking.
I'm psychic. We'll cover that later. Because you're already thinking Fluffy, you're going to create minuscule movements, often mm-hmm. outside your own awareness, that are going to kind of move you in the direction of the letter F and work your way through.
Gotcha.
And the original Ouija boards were not this heavy cardboard like what they're made of today. It was more of a light paper, like a waxy kind of paper. And the planchette was a lot lighter.
So
those minuscule movements were even easier to move people around the board.
So then it does feel magical. Nobody in the group really feels like they owned that, but your tiny movement made somebody else feel. And so it goes there.
And then you move along. And then you feel that too, because you don't realize that you're moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. And they found that this ideomotor phenomenon can also be used with, they think, people who are dowsing, although there's a lot of weird science with dowsing, or using a pendulum. Some people will like hold a pendulum over a map or over a yes, no kind of thing mm-hmm. and looking for a swing and that sort of thing. And I'm going to have up on the website, there was kind of an interesting research discussion about kind of self-testing yourself with the pendulum.
Oh.
And you can give it a shot, and talking about how it naturally swings one way or another, and that you'll find that you might even wind up giving yourself the answer that you expected.
Uh-huh.
But now if you're, this can be overrun if you are trying to fight the system. You know, mm-hmm. this effect works when you believe that it's working.
Yeah, you have to have some buy-in, otherwise
you're gonna fight it. It's like hypnotism.
It.
Yes. Okay, so Amy said that she had to have the last thing because it was so cool, I would feel bad if I had to come after this.
Yes. I would like to talk about Carlos Ray Norris. He was born on March 10th in 1940, and he actually built the hospital he was born in. And later on, you'll find out that he became Chuck Norris.
Wait, he built the hospital he was born in?
Yeah. And Chuck doesn't blow out his birthday candles. He suffocates them with his stare. He was born to...
I feel like this is a Blarney thing.
There are many true facts here. He was born to Wilma and Ray. And when Chuck Norris turned 18, his parents moved out.
What?
Chuck Norris, he described himself as scholastically mediocre and downbeat. He was non-athletic and shy. But now when he does push-ups, he's not pushing his body up. He's pushing the earth down.
Is that what he actually says?
That's what the internet knows, Trace.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Norris has many black belts. He is a highly decorated martial artist. He has, I'm going to tell you about all of his belts. He's actually created his own martial art, Chun Kuk Do, and it might be Cook, I'm not sure. And when Chuck Norris goes target shooting, he hits 11 out of 10 targets with 9 bullets. He has a 9th degree black belt in Tang Sudo, and he has a grizzly bear rug in his room. It's not dead. It's just afraid to move. He holds an 8th degree black belt in Taekwondo, and the flu has to get a Chuck Norris shot each year.
God.
True story. He was originally, by the way, trained in Tang Sudo. That was his first martial art, which he learned in the military and kind of brought him out of his. So this is actually real true Chuck Norris stuff.
Oh, okay.
He was a pretty shy guy. He joined the military and was introduced to Tang Sudo, so that he's got a 9th dan belt in that, and moved on to other martial arts, and then eventually opened a martial arts school and was sort of the martial arts teacher to the stars. And so he has taught people like the Osmond siblings, Donnie and Marie. Steve McQueen is really the one that kind of pulled him in and said, you know, you're a really engaging guy. Would you be interested? You should consider this. And that's how he got involved. But in that process, he also has got a 5th degree belt in karate. He's got a 3rd degree Brazilian jiu-jitsu belt. He's got a black belt in judo. And Chuck Norris has been to Mars. That's why there's no signs of life there. Fun pet fact. Who wins a fight between King Kong and Godzilla? Neither. Chuck Norris doesn't let his pets fight. And my final and favorite Chuck Norris fact that we're going to end our show with today. Chuck Norris doesn't fart. Nothing escapes Chuck Norris. Darn it, I thought I could get through it. I practiced.
Well, I don't know what's fact or fiction anymore, but that's okay.
A lot of that was true. Trace is going to collect herself while I ask you to come visit Brain Junk Podcast. We'll have pictures of Chuck Norris's pets and more there for you. Some examples of more. Okay, Chuck Norris actually has a Chuck Norris joke feed on his website. So I will link you to his website, which is really quite fun. He has a wonderful sense of humor. That's a really true fact.
We'll have screaming mice and the scary beaded lace wing and a picture of the Ouija board. You don't have to look at it if it's too scary for you. It's okay.
Yep. For this and other wonderful episodes, look for Brain Junk wherever you find your podcasts. And please don't forget to like and subscribe.
We tweet at My Brain Junk, and you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Brain Junk Podcast. Drop us a line at brainjunkpodcast@gmail.com with your questions and episode ideas. Amy and I will catch you next time when we share more of everything you never knew you wanted to know, and I guarantee you will not be bored.
Not if I have anything to do with it.